Hey, Robin.
Good evening. What should we talk about today?
We are going to talk about this paper that just came out in Philosophy and Public Affairs called The Etiquette of Equality by a law professor named Benjamin Idelson. And let me give a really quick summary of the paper, and then you've read it more recently than I have, so you can like add what you think is significant to it. But the thesis is that at least there are some communicative norms about like how we talk to each other, what categories, how we describe the categories that we're in, that exist as a means of expressing recognition of equality. And the norm as to exactly how you should express that recognition can change over time. And if you don't adhere to those norms, people will experience that as being disrespectful and that you're treating them as though they're not equal to you. And these questions about how you should talk can be particularly sensitive with respect to groups that have been historically oppressed. And basically we can understand all of that, a lot of what would be called sort of like wokeism as really being what he calls the etiquette of equality, that is observing norms of etiquette and respect so as to treat one another as equal members of a community. However, he notes that this the kind of like symbolic baggage that a conversation has can become more and more over time, and it can be sort of so freighted down that it's hard to communicate, and it can even be in some ways self-destructive. That this kind of etiquette of equality has like a bit of a tendency to what's the right phrase? What am I struggling to say, Robin?
Well, you're wondering whether to describe it as some autonomous social force or to give credit to actors intentionally making choices here to
Yeah, I
cause
was
these
really
things.
thinking of the first thing. I was thinking of the kind of self-destructive aspect of it. That not only does this etiquette make communication difficult, it actually also makes communication of respect difficult in a variety of ways. So it's bad in both of those two ways, I guess. That seems an important part of his thesis. Yeah, that's what I take the paper to argue, but maybe you can add or say it better than I did.
So we're talking about signaling equilibria in economics terms. So take an analogy of wearing a suit to an interview. You might not think it matters what you wear to an interview, but once everybody sees wearing a suit to an interview as a sign you're serious and respectful of the interview, then not wearing a suit becomes a sign of disrespect. And therefore, you're an interview in an equilibrium where you need to wear a suit if you want to be treated seen as treating the situation respectfully. And that can be then a pooling equilibrium. Once everybody knows about it, then almost everybody does it, and almost nobody suffers much harm except for the fact that you have to wear a suit. Now, if we upped the standards such that it had to be a tuxedo, perhaps happened to be a 300-pound iron suit or something, you can imagine that different equilibria would have different overall consequences. But we can at least see the logic that you need to be respectful. And so this article is talking about use of language with respect to gender and race and things like that in a similar way that if there's an expectation that you're supposed to use a certain sort of word or not use another one as a sign of respect, then you, in an equilibrium, when everybody interprets it that way, then if you choose to do otherwise and you understand the equilibrium you're in, you are in fact disrespecting those people by not making the usual symbol. And that's the usual context of etiquette. But, you know, as he discusses, usually when we think of etiquette, we think of relatively stable equilibria that last over long periods and are similar across a very wide scope. And then mostly it's about negatives, things not to do. And he says we can more easily just remember those and not do them and get along. But what we have is this recent phenomena where, at least in some communities, the standards have slowly been elevated, and they change over time, somewhat rapid way, and they have increasing demands. They make it harder to satisfy. And he says that at some point it looks a lot like, well, what people really want to do is to have you reveal your sort of overall political stance with in how you say these things, and then they might be able to trust you about race or gender if you are sufficiently politically aligned with them. And he thinks that's problematic if we need to have situations where you cannot flag your political stance in order to discuss things, such as a teacher teaching about abortion, say. He gives that example. And then he also goes into the most detail about this story about a law professor at Georgetown, Ilya Shapiro. That's his most extended example.
Right.
And in that example, he says Shapiro literally just gave an argument that was against affirmative action on meritocratic grounds, but people interpreted him as saying something negative about blacks in general. That was literally wrong, but people also thought, but the fact that he allowed himself to be misinterpreted that way was the bad signal he sent. And no one should ever say anything that should allow themselves to be falsely interpreted as saying that. And then that's an example of this escalation of the standards. And, you know, that sort of escalation makes it hard to communicate and seems to give power to people who can create new test cases. That is, it might not have been true before this case that was seen as a illicit thing to do, but people could declare this illicit and dare the administration to defy them. And then by acquiescing to that, you know, demand, they were showing respect for those students and their position, but then giving power to people in the future to continue to simply declare new things as illicit and offensive and expand the space of all the rules we have to follow. And, you know, where does all that go, I guess,
yeah.
You say.
And so, go ahead.
Well, so there's the final observation that we might think that in any one situation, once we realize this larger problem, we might think that, you know, going along with such student demands would be producing a consequence for the world that was bad, and even bad for the people who were, you know, the supposed victims here, the people who are being disrespected, because we might lead to a world where they are more often seen as disrespected. But that each one of us has a higher priority, typically, in showing that we personally are with the cause. And so we will then go along with this escalation as a way to personally show that we are, and he thinks that's in many ways morally required, that as morality requires that we each do the thing that show us personally to be more moral, even if that leads to bad consequences.
Yeah, I want to say something about that, but then I want to put forward a hypothesis about what is causing this escalation, because he doesn't actually address that in the paper. Okay, on this last point, like, you know, he sort of takes it for granted that it's like, he might say, well, maybe the public good would be better served in some way by me fighting these demands to be more sensitive. But individually, my moral demand is that I be more sensitive, right? As you just put it, it's not at all obvious to me that fighting it doesn't fuel it. That is, that consequent, if we think of the fighting consequentialistically, it seems to me that the cases where people have fought it, that then gives it a lot of, gets a lot of attention. And then I think it's at least plausible to think that causes more of these demands and makes, kind of draws attention to it and fuels the war. And so it you might think it would be better if the demands de-escalated, but it's not at all clear to me that fighting leads to, in any way, to de-escalation.
So that's directly related to the question of what caused this. The theory that fighting it would escalate it would seem to predict it's inevitable. Escalation is inevitable, of course, yet we had long periods in the past when escalation didn't even happen. So it certainly wasn't always inevitable. So then the question is, what changed to make it not only happen, but to become inevitable, to reach a what maximum? Now you might say, well, this theory of inevitable rise would not limit how far it could go.
No, I don't.
It'll have to all.
I don't think it's inevitable rise. So I think it's like the same way when you have like a little kid and they're like complaining about something, often you're going to aggravate their complaints by like arguing with them about it and fighting them on it. And I think that that's like typically you inflame a war by fighting it, especially a culture war. So I don't think this is inevitable, but I think that at least the high profile cases of fighting it seem to me to have the effect of inflaming it. And maybe in some way they have the intended effect of inflaming it, because you can gain some notoriety and acclaim for yourself by fighting it, and by claiming the, you know, brave standard of like fighting for this thing. And that's sort of what that move has turned into. Fighting it itself is like a symbolic move. But that's not to say it's inevitable. It's just to say that I think is the likely outcome under the current set of circumstances.
Well, then we need a theory about what would cause it not to rise. That is, if any time someone makes a demand, everybody is well advised to give in to the demand, because otherwise that will escalate it, then there doesn't seem to be much pressure to resist making more demands. Then do they just get tired of making demands, or what?
I'm not claiming people should give in to the demand. That's not my claim at all. My claim is that because maybe you should fight it and make it worse. Like that. But my point is just it's pretty likely that fighting it will make it worse. So.
But that's what I wasn't arguing about whether it was good or bad. I was just saying that if fighting it made it worse, and then whenever somebody makes the demand, you have the choice to give in or to fight, then under both responses, it would be worse. So that means anytime anybody makes a demand, it becomes worse. Therefore, the question is, what other scenarios are there other than people making demands and getting worse?
Typically, have a lot of other options. People just only see those two. So, in general, like you can, for instance, get the person to change their mind. That's another demand. That's another approach.
Okay, that doesn't sound very plausible in this case, though, right?
Maybe not. I mean, I it may well be that these sort of high-profile cases are not like the most important cases, in terms of like. But let me switch over, because I think we're jumping to talk about the solution. I wanted to get that point in, which is to say, it's just not at all obvious that fighting it has the desired effect. I think that's important to point that out. What you should do, that's a separate question. But let's talk about the cause. So my theory about the cause is related to the end of his paper. So the end of his paper says that we live in a society that doesn't treat its members as equals. So we live in an unequal society. Okay. That is, we live in an inegalitarian society, a racist society, a sexist society, a homophobic society, a transphobic society. Suppose we believe that. Suppose we believe that's true about our society. And now suppose that that's our backdrop. And I wanted to signal to you that I treat you as an equal. Then there's something funny going on, which is that I have to be signaling to you that I'm an exception. Right? I have to say, I'm not like the rest of the society, which is sexist, homophobic, etc. I'm different. So the signal, I think, is caught between two, what I would call like two different worlds of signaling. One would be like etiquette, where the way that etiquette works is typically that sort of like everybody has a background sense of this is how we do things, like the suit, right? And that just becomes like the norm. And then like the shibboleth, right? Where there's like a secret message that I can send you. I can use like a code or something to say a secret handshake, like the Mason's handshake, right? That I can use to say, I'm in the group that you're in. That's a different kind of signal. And the Adelson treats this this topic as though it were squarely inside of the etiquette of etiquette style signaling, but I think it's really caught between etiquette style signaling and shibboleth style signaling, and that's what leads to the escalation. Because anything that would serve as a signal that I see you as an equal, once enough people start adopting it, it's no longer clear that I'm different from the majority of people who are inegalitarian, and I can no longer communicate to you with that means that I am an egalitarian. And so we keep having to shift the signal so that I can stand out from the group.
So I know many associates who are libertarian. I haven't spent much time myself in that world, but they tell me, and I believe them, that in that world, there's this escalation phenomena where once there are some things accepted by most libertarians, some of them have to find a way to be more libertarian and sort right. of reject not just, you know, government runs cafeterias, but then to reject government run schools and then maybe government run law and military. They just try to go one farther in because there's a sense in which they're trying to show themselves to be the most pure. And I would offer a similar explanation here. I think it complements yours, which is to say, we didn't see this escalation for many decades in the past, but in the last decade, we have seen basically a religious revival and a lot of people eager to show how dedicated they are to a new religion or cause or movement. And then they have this attempt to show that they are more dedicated than each other. And that would be the driving force for escalating the demands that once many people are, you know, sufficiently dedicated to the cause, if you want to show that you are extra dedicated to the cause, then you have to raise the standard.
I mean, I guess I don't find the religious framing to be particularly helpful because it seems to me that the phenomenon is broader. That is, that what's happening here is that there's an intersection between the logic of etiquette and the logic of shibboleth. Right. And the logic of shibboleths is like a secret code used by an in-group to recognize one another. And the logic of etiquette is, you know, a set of norms whereby we all that a set of norms that like everyone can be held to. Right. Generally. And the problem is we're trying to do both those things at the same time. We're trying to have a set of norms that everyone can be held to. But we also want those same norms to be able to distinguish you. As being in the right group. And when those two demands come together, you get this funny kind of escalation. But as far as I could tell, they could come together in a variety of different like forms of like culture, such that religion is only one of them, and it wouldn't necessarily be the case that a religion would have to have this character. I think Judaism doesn't much have this character, even though it's a
religion. I just meant religion in a relatively general term, which can include ideologies or other sort of strong movements, such as, you know, the Chinese Cultural Revolution or the anti-communist campaign of the 1950s in the U.S. or the sort of Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. Just a lot of people are into a new concept of what's good and what they share in common, and that they are eager to show their devotion to it.
Maybe revolution is the better word then, that this doesn't have anything to do with religion.
Okay.
It's something like a revolutionary mindset.
So let's take the example of being anti-communist in the U.S.
Right.
There was a period where people were trying to show that they were anti-communist once the communist revolution happened in Russia in 1917. And over time, people were more eager to show their anti-communist bona fides. And so I happen to know that at one point in the medical world, many people liked the idea of an HMO, which we have today, a health maintenance organization, where doctors are paid per month to take care of patients. And that was called communist by the medical establishment and banned basically until a congressional bill and by Nixon signed in the early 1970s made HMOs much more widespread. But the key idea was that we escalated our idea of what communism was, so that it, allowing or even supporting an HMO in a capitalist society became communist. And I think we saw other sorts of escalation of the concept, such that anything associated with communism became repudiated. And that would be sort of another example of a movement trying to show how dedicated they are to the movement, escalating the demand.
Right. And so, if we want to say, what are going to be the conditions for this kind of escalation? It seems to me that on the one hand, you need to have the thought that not everyone belongs to the group, right? So that so that's the shibboleth side, right? So not everyone is an adherent or belongs to it or whatever. But then on the other hand, that's not enough, right? Because you could just have a little secret society where they're happy with being their secret society, like the Freemasons. But then you also have the idea, and everyone is supposed to belong to that group, right?
Not just that we're all trying to belong to this group, but that some of us are really not, and there's the traitors among us, and we're each trying to say, I'm not one of the traitors among us, but we're all suspicious that they're all around, and basically we're all trying to, in a sense, point fingers at the others to say, there's your traitor, not me.
But I don't think that's some additional principle you've just cited. That is, so this is what I want you to push back against me if you think this is wrong, but like the stuff that you're adding is just how it is natural for the equilibrium to work out if you have both the an element of etiquette, namely it applies to everyone, and the element of the shibboleth, namely that only some people are currently committed to it. If you take those two things, you're going to end up with the suspicion and the proving that you're pure and you're real or whatever. All of that is just a consequence of this combination of etiquette world and shibboleth world.
I'm just saying that that's a common scenario when there's a widely popular revolution where it's also widely suspected that many supposed supporters are really less supported than they let on. That is, there's social pressure to support the revolution, and we all kind of don't think we're all as on board as we say.
Right. And I think like it's interesting, right, that like when it comes to like etiquette, right, like I think we've the situation in which norms of etiquette have felt most present to me is like when, and I think you've been in the scenario, when I was at Oxford once and sitting at like high table and there's, you know, this order that everything has to be done and then you move to a different room and then there's the sherry and it's on a train and all this weird stuff is happening where you might be rude. And it like, the thing about that is that it really does not at all feel like a competition to show that you're the most etiquette-y around. It doesn't feel like it's a mechanism of let's prove who is a true nobility versus isn't. That's not how, anyway, I didn't experience it that way. It's just like, this is a setting, here are the norms. Some people might screw up, but we're not like testing to see who really belongs. And that's because it truly is just etiquette. That's how etiquette works. And in order to get this other side, the shibboleth side, in order to get the suspicion and the feel like you need to prove that you really belong and all of that, there has to be this thought, the thought that Idelson expresses when he says we live in an unequal society. That is, we're trying to signal that we're all equal, but we're also trying to signal that in the context of a mutual understanding that we don't all think we're equal. That's the problem.
Well, in addition to that problem, though, there's the fact that we all used to be thinking we had a relatively stable situation of our relative attitudes about inequality. And then recently a movement arose wherein many people wanted to show that they were with the movement and then escalating with the movement's escalation. And that would be more of an explanation for the escalation over time in the standards.
So I'm trying to give an explanation of that that wouldn't require you to import any of those things. It would explain those things. And it would have to be, the explanation would have to be that either we came to believe to a greater degree than we had earlier, or we came to be to a greater degree than we were earlier, that unequal. So, came to adopt the requirements of equality to a stronger degree. So one of those two things would change. So either the etiquette side or the shibboleth side would have to change, such that we then get, and then that's going to explain the escalation. That's going to cause the escalation. Any situation.
I think that's roughly the same story. It's just focusing on different aspects of it. But yes, that is, when a revolution arises, you create a raised expectation for sort of changes people should be advocating for and embodying. That's, in a sense, what a revolution is, a set of raised expectations about what will happen soon and who's to be held to what standards.
Right. And okay, so maybe let's talk about the thing I'm most interested in is this idea of secondhand, thirdhand, or fourthhand communication, like as in the Shapiro case, where the objection to him is not that he said anything offensive, but that he should have predicted that it could have been misunderstood as offensive. And the fact his being willing to assert something of that kind is a signal. That is, he's being willing to assert something that he could have predicted might be misunderstood as offensive. That's what's offensive, is that signal.
So I think we can see that process in a related process, which is once Shapiro has been through this process of labeled, perhaps incorrectly, as someone who isn't very sensitive to equality, then right. If you were to associate with him in some public way, then people might take you as, therefore, presumptively insufficiently attentive to inequality by the fact that you were associated with him. And then I might have that same problem associating with you. And in each of these cases, we're less concerned about whether it's true that this other person was, in fact, you know, less concerned about inequality or more willing to offend it than that there's this wide perception that they are. And so we have this general rule that once an accusation's made, it doesn't really matter if it's true. We're all supposed to act as if it's true because that's the sort of thing somebody who cared about this issue would do.
Right. And like the question is like, I mean, suppose that that's right. The question is like, what are the costs of that? Right. So it seems to me that there are two potential costs. So the second one, I have a bit of a harder time getting into view. So one cost is just like, if you and I right now in this conversation, we're mainly attending to how might people be misinterpreting us, then we wouldn't be very focused on like what each other was actually saying and on the argument, right? So there's a kind of distraction from the literal content that's going to be produced by maybe it's pretty similar to how if like right now I mainly thought that you're going to respond to my physical appearance or something, that was like the main thing you're going to be concerned with, then that would make me, I would be like, oh, let me hold my face in a certain way or something, and let me, you know, that's what I'd be paying attention to rather than like, what am I actually saying to you? So there's just a question of whether your attention is tracking like the informational content of what you're saying. And so it seems like in this kind of equilibrium, your attention is not going to track that. It's going to track something else.
Sure. Although I think, you know, with respect to some sacred cause, people often don't mind sacrificing that way, making a public visible sacrifice for the cause. And we often are distracted by many other considerations in our conversations. So it goes as one of many kinds of distractions, right? We're often distracted by showing our how high status we are, how well-read we are, et cetera. The other harm, though, that seems especially problematic is In the old Soviet Union, at times of, great stress, people would out other people as running dog capitalists. And then those people would be taken off to Siberia, and it became an ability that anybody could sort of take out their rival by making such an accusation. And then you just get people, basically firing first in a sort of a shooting contest where whoever makes the accusation first gets rid of their rival. And doesn't really matter if it's true. And so you could just get escalation of, people, there was the old, the first reality TV show was Survivor, where a bunch of people on the island, and they all voted people off the island, the question who was left. And of course, their very first votes would be to take them, the strongest competitors that they most feared in the game, and try to take them off the island first. And then toward the end, there would be people who initially weren't perceived as being threats, but are now the people who are left. But this seems like a bad equilibrium, where if we just accept accusations because they're accusations, then people will be incentivized to accuse and demand, right? If people make a demand and you look bad if you don't give in to the demand, then people will just make more and more demands.
Yeah. For me, when I want to talk about the costs, I want to have a sense of, okay, what's that going to pay out? And so suppose more people get accused and more people make demands. Why is that worse? On Survivor, it's not obvious to me that they should have organized the game of Survivor in some different way. It's not obvious that was some kind of bad equilibrium. Maybe it made for a good show. If I say, okay, because of this, we can't, there's something we want to say to each other and we can't say it. That to me is a very palpable cost. I guess I do appreciate bad things are going to happen to people and they didn't deserve those things, like being sent to Siberia. Fair enough. I agree that's a cost. But I guess I kind of, besides for the, I didn't want to give in to those demands and I was unfairly accused. Do you see those as the main costs? Because I guess I see the main cost really as punitive and not of those, even though those are costs.
Well, they do interact in the sense that often if we're in the Survivor game saying, who are we all going to vote for to get rid of, anybody who stands out as weird or uncomfortable in some way becomes a, plausible shared target. So people who say things that other people find uncomfortable, even if they're not, disrespecting equality, still we might go, well, let's get rid of them with this excuse because we have this excuse to get rid of people. And that might discourage people from saying things that other people might find uncomfortable.
Right. But then is that good? I mean, that is so then we need a premise like it's good for people to say things that other people find uncomfortable, which it might be. I'm just saying I would need.
Right.
That's going to give us a special kind of information that we otherwise are going to lose. And it's especially bad to lose those people.
Right. So a common story of the intellectual world is we all sort of get stuck on the usual point of view. And then somebody comes along and challenges the usual point of view. And that's initially uncomfortable, but sometimes successful, gets us to rethink things and change our mind about things. But initially we don't like to have to rethink things and change our mind about things. And we would rather push them away.
I think there's a case to be made, though, that, in the cancel culture world, there's obviously a huge resistance to that. That's a big part of the movement is the counter movement, as I was saying earlier, that fuels the movement itself. And it may be that certain kinds of iconoclastic individuals who nobody would have paid any attention to them at all or have had any interest in them, now they become symbols of the opposition, right? And so it could be that at least some of those countercultural thinkers gain a prominence that they wouldn't have under the more ordinary equilibrium.
I mean, that's theoretically possible. I just don't believe it's true in practice. That is, I see far more people who don't reach the limelight who are, censoring themselves or quietly censored, quietly canceled, than people who are publicly done so. But, we don't have to settle that per se to continue this topic.
Right. I mean, you may be right that people are censoring themselves more than they would have, right, in the other world. But like that's not the only relevant consideration. The other relevant consideration is, would anyone have cared what they thought in that other world? That is, most people find most intellectuals totally boring and irrelevant and have zero interest in them. And so even if they don't self-censor, no one's listening. So it may be that a world where like most intellectuals have to self-censor is still a world where weird intellectuals get more of a hearing, because a few of them do actually get a hearing.
Again, my reading of the situation is just nothing like that. That is, there's a small number of people who get publicly canceled and they get a little more attention, and there's vastly more people who get quietly canceled and who self-censor. So that we're just looking at a small percentage.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm saying compare it to the other scenario. Would all of those people, the ones who are self-censoring, have had a kind of prominence and a public platform in that world? Or would a larger percentage of them than the percentage that now get the public acclaim? That's the question. All I'm saying is that's the relevant question.
Well, so, I mean, a usual concept of this is to imagine a real or perhaps somewhat idealized actual open intellectual community, and then to imagine or see what happens to it when it gets under the pressure of censorship and insulation. That is, the story is that at least before this transition, people were more open to arguments and open to uncomfortable arguments and engaging them. And then after this transition, that stuff cut back a lot.
Yeah, I mean, so it's interesting that you're proposing that comparison with the status quo and the ideal world. And I was proposing the comparison between the status quo and what there was before the status quo.
That's what I meant to do. That's what I was trying to say. I was trying to talk about.
We didn't live in the ideal world before, did we? That would be amazing.
No, but we did live in a world where people were often saying uncomfortable things and things that other people didn't want to hear, and things that could be misinterpreted but weren't misinterpreted as disrespecting people. And now the claim is there's now actually much more conformity pressure. There are many more topics that you can't talk about, and there are many ordinary topics you can talk about that you have to be very careful how you talk about them, and that even when you do everything right, you are still more often randomly canceled or sent off the island because of, it's just one of the possibility of things that can happen to you now. It's when rivals don't like you. So that's the claim, is that's a worse intellectual world.
Right. I think that the claim that I'm making is something like, you correct me if I'm wrong, that we used to have something more like a pooling equilibrium, and now we have something more like a separating equilibrium. And that separating equilibrium is still, there's not, like, I'm not denying all the oppression, so that in effect, those people are getting pulled in with the good behavior. But still, there's, it seems to me, at least it doesn't seem crazy to say there is more iconoclasm and people standing out in this world than there was in the older world.
It just doesn't seem true to me.
Okay.
So one of the axes he talks about in the paper is sort of the flagging of people's political orientation as a prerequisite for discussion. So I think it is more true that half a century ago and up until recently, in order to enter many kinds of conversations, it was just not necessary to show you were a good progressive. You could be ambiguous about your politics and introduce arguments, and they could be accepted and or engaged at least. And that the story here is, more recently, for some kinds of topics at least, one must signal that one's a good progressive to even have standing on the subject. And that limits the kinds of positions you're allowed to take. And so that was Shapiro's fault here in this example. That is, because he was anti-affirmative action, people could presume that he must have been anti-Black. And so if he said the word Black, then people were justified in assuming he was anti-Black because he was anti-affirmative action. And that his being on the wrong side of the regressive politics on that one issue was the thing that allowed people to justify themselves in assuming incorrectly his meaning on that topic. And that in the past, that wasn't such a criteria.
Right.
And I've certainly experienced that on some topics. There is just a set of people who aren't, in some sense, allowed to talk about certain topics. They don't have standing. You only have standing on certain topics if you have the right gender or race or other conditions and the right politics. And people often have to go out of their way to spend the first third of their article or whatever making it really clear their heart is in the right place on politics before they would dare to discuss some sensitive issue.
So let me ask another question that relates to this paper, which is Idelson is inclined to frame it in terms of the thought that etiquette norms exist as a way of recognizing equality. And so, for example, the way that you're talking, it's almost like, oh, maybe only somebody of the relevant race or gender would be in a position to produce this kind of recognition, to make the reader feel like they're seeing them as equal or something. To me, the odd thing about this, it doesn't strictly conflict with what he says, but I don't feel like most social norms are about signaling equality. I think they're mostly about signaling inequality. That is, we have lots of really complicated social hierarchies that show up even at the high table in Oxford, or when I give a talk, people are always thanking me for my time. They're like, thank you so much for coming to this, and I'm like, well, you also came to this talk, right? But they like to signal to me, in effect, that my time is more valuable than their time. And that's they see that as an important way of being respectful to me. And the respect they're trying to show me is not equality. And it just seems to me that very, very much of our architecture of signaling respect to one another is not aimed at signaling equality. It's aimed at signaling inequality.
So I think it's absolutely correct. Ann Landers and Miss Manners, I'm sure, would agree the vast majority of etiquette isn't about showing equality. So I think this author is basically trying to be generous to these kinds of new social norms by calling them etiquette. And that's his framing is trying to be generous that way.
But why would that be generous if most etiquette is about showing inequality? Then wouldn't etiquette be problematic if what he's into is equality?
But if he called it instead something other than etiquette, if he called it new signaling demands of loyalty or something, that would be less appealing. Okay, but still, etiquette is more widely accepted. So by calling it etiquette, he's describing it as something we all tend to accept as a reasonable thing to have, whereas we might not with other sorts of framing. So I think, yes, the vast majority of etiquette is not about equality, and we might find it hard to find much of any other etiquette that's about equality. But this new set of norms that people have tried to introduce, they could claim it's more about equality, and so then he could generously describe it as an etiquette of equality.
Right.
He goes way out of his way to really emphasize how he thinks it's completely legitimate that we should be going out of our way to signal our concern for equality. That seems to me,
I'm sorry. It's my bad internet.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, we will venture on.
Yeah. I mean, I have to go in 5 or 5 to 10 minutes anyway, but, it did strike me that the piece itself includes a bit of a reference to the fact that it is caught in this very dynamic. Right. There's like one place where, he, as an aside, like basically, it's like he understands that in this essay he has to signal in just that way, right? So it's not an accident that it does that. Like it self-consciously does it, and he justifies doing it in the piece. He thinks this is the right thing to do. But I think the thing that we haven't discussed in the piece yet that I find so interesting is not just the communicative cost, but the self-destructive aspect of it, which is that if in order to show that I respect you, I have to say, use a particular word for you, but then that word keeps changing. And then it's actually hard for me to show respect for you. And I'm going to be disrespecting you, or at least on average, you're going to be disrespected more in that world, in the world where it's really challenging for people to show that they respect you. So this whole movement that exists in order to show equal respect, this escalation of what it would take to show respect actually creates a world with less showing of respect.
Well, we could also think about it more like we talked previously about, say, romance and, you know, testing a romantic partner for their devotion, right? So if we had a dating equilibrium where it was relatively easy for 80% of people to satisfy the demands, then all you would know is that they were in the top 80%, and maybe that's not good enough for deciding whether you like someone. And so this new equilibrium is more making a separating equilibrium where you can show people where they are in a whole entire ranking. And if you really care about whether they're in the top 20%, because you want to know if they're really super devoted to the cause, like you might in dating, then you might prefer a separating equilibrium where we can say, sure, you're at the 50 percentile of respect, but that's not good enough. I want to know who's higher.
Right, and that makes perfect sense with dating because you're only going to date like one person.
Right.
The whole framing of the piece is that this is like the background conditions for respect, for having a classroom discussion, for having public discussion. And when applied to those contexts, and then you're cutting out most of the people, that seems like a problem.
But in many sorts of revolutions, we have the revolutionary cadre in charge of the revolution, and everybody else is supposed to go along with them. They're supposed to be the small elite, and everybody else is supposed to shut up and go along and not question. And this is a stereotypical equilibrium. Many people described in many actual revolutions and other cases where this is the bad situation we could fall into, where only the priest is allowed to have any opinions and the rest of us just must repeat them. And if we ever question any of them, that's the bad signal that we are not a good person and cannot be trusted and should be sent to Siberia.
I feel like there's another thing, and you're going to disagree with me about this, but that makes this very different for a revolution, which is like really not much is happening. That is, all the demands tend to be symbolic and there don't tend to be a lot of real effects. And there isn't some basic social reorganization underway, except for these demands to prove that you're in the group. So it's kind of oddly empty as a revolution. It's a revolution that isn't, and people have made this complaint. Freddie de Boer has made this complaint. I think his new book is about this, that obviously I haven't read yet because he has not published yet, but it's about sort of like, wokeism having taken over leftist politics to the point where leftist politics no longer tries to achieve any real change. So the idea is that this quote unquote revolution is a revolution to do nothing. So in that way, it's not exactly a revolution.
It's still the early days. I think this has several more decades to go. It might also be different and more focused on symbolism. I think that's a complaint. I guess Martin Gurry has his book, The Revolt of the Public, that came out 10 years ago, saying that most major revolutions in the last decade before he wrote the book were more symbolic. That is, they were not willing to have leaders and who represented them. They more wanted to have an egalitarian group where they all, just had the same level and appearance. And that made them less able to actually get things done, but they more liked the internal feeling of it. And maybe that's also true here. But, they do make demands in those other revolutions, whether they achieve it or not. This revolution is having substantial effects. I see actual effects. So, and I think it's got a long way to go. But regardless of that, it's still a potent equilibrium, even when you just have to make these verbal loyalty signals, because it can be hard to do as they change and get complicated and the demands increase.
Okay, we should probably stop there.
Okay, till next time.